This is the November 18th environmental law class. We have just completed the brief review of CERCLA. We're about to go through the CERCLA process, settlement strategies, and allocation liability issues. Now, as I was saying, I do sometimes tend to pick on the book, but I do want to also say that the book has a fairly nice description, although very compressed, of the CERCLA process. So I would recommend it to your reading. I'm not talking about the cases, I'm talking about that little introductory textual description. Having said that, I wanted to elaborate and fill it out a little bit so you have a better sense of how it works. The first fundamental thing about Superfund is you need to keep in mind that there are two different kinds of cleanups. So if we were to walk out, find an oozing pit in the middle of the field, our first question is going to be, if we're, for example, EPA, are we going to do a removal action or a remedial action? The statute itself acknowledges the distinction between the two. The removal action is emergency short-term response. You've got a really nasty situation. You need to deal with it fast. As a result, much less procedural burden, much less paperwork, but it's usually limited to 1 year. It can be extended to 2 years by specific EPA extension. It also needs to be limited to $1 million. Although, again, that too can be doubled subject to EPA approval.
Is that in terms of total cleanup costs?
That's just for the removal.
Okay.
Just for removal. Remember, you can have a removal followed by a full-scale remedial action. I may take your question, and now I'm going to pervert it slightly, if you don't mind. In addition to removal versus, well, removal or remedial, the other fork in the road to think about is whether or not what I'll call government or enforcement lead versus private lead. That's called PRP lead. The enforcement lead is when the agency says, I'm going to clean this up. I'm not waiting for anybody else. And usually it's EPA, but that national contingency plan I described earlier will oftentimes say another agency takes lead status. So like, for example, if you have certain types of cleanups dealing with natural resource damages and federal held land, you deal with a different agency. But typically EPA calls the shots. Okay. Any other questions? The other thing about removal is that it has a different statute of limitations period, which I'll come back to a little bit, but you may find yourself scrapping in a court over whether or not something's removed or remedial because millions of dollars disappear because your statute period is run under removal but hasn't run under remedial. Remedial is opposite. It is the long haul cleanup. There are cleanups lasting for decades that are going to continue to last for decades. It is the ones designed to permanently clean up the site. As a result, you don't have the cash cap like you do with removal. But you have much more extensive procedural requirements and obligations you must satisfy to go through a full-scale remediation. Now, as a result, I'm going to sort of give you a quick step through the process just to give you a flavor of how it works. I'm not expecting you to have all the particular names of these steps in mind, but just to sort of let you know how it kind of actually makes sense. The first is a preliminary assessment or site investigation, or PASI is the acronym. This is 10,000 foot flyby. This is the very quick, easy look to see if there really is a problem. As a result, you're not necessarily doing a lot of sampling. You're not necessarily doing a lot of groundwater investigation. You're not digging through records. What you're doing is just going out there and seeing, is there waste on site, and can it get out in a way that hurts people? As part of that process, you will oftentimes do what's called a hazard ranking score. This is the SAT for Superfund sites. Every Superfund site has to be scored under this hazard ranking score package to see if it is bad enough, its score is high enough, to be subject to full-scale remedial treatment. The score typically is 28.5, pick your flavor. That's why I told you in Texas, we have a state Superfund. Anything that falls below that hazard ranking score package to go to federal gets picked up by the Texas program. But essentially, this hazard ranking score package looks at people drinking the groundwater, looks at whether the stormwater runs off to where people live, looks at whether or not there's certain wildlife that's potentially impacted, and gives you a quick and dirty, yes, this site needs our attention. After you've gone through that process, next up is actually the listing on what's called the National Priority List. This is the comprehensive master list of all the Superfund sites in the nation that are federal lead sites undergoing remediation. It's roughly around close to 2,000 right now sites. A lot of them, this process is administrative. It goes through public notice and comment. You can have people basically having submitting objections to adding a site to the list. A lot of it's a skirmishing procedure, but once you're on this list, you get the good side, from the agency's perspective, you get money. You're now free to tap the federal super fund to clean up the site. The bad side is that it's like a roach motel. Once you go in, it's very, very hard to get a site off the NPL list. Besides having the HRS package getting high enough to score, you can also have sites added to the National Priorities List because the state's governor says that has to be on our list. We are exercising our rights as a state to insist that this site be added. There's only a limited number the state can do, but if it's a high enough site politically or other concerns, even if the score may be a little bit unquestioned, the state has the ability to put sites onto the list. So it's all hanging together so far? Now, believe it or not, this process I've just described to you looks like it's fairly bureaucratic and would take a long time, sort of our common themes with environmental law. But the truth is, this goes pretty fast. I mean, if we were to go out and find the oozing pit of death somewhere here on campus, we could have a PASI done fairly quickly because EPA has a roster of contractors who will just come out almost instantly and within a space of weeks to months have that hazard ranking scoring package ready, publish it in the public national priorities list, and that site can be on the NPL within a space of a year. Sometimes it's longer, sometimes much longer, but typically the process to this point is designed to go very quickly. But as you can tell, there's a butt coming. At this point, it starts going slowly, because now you're starting to take a hard look at what you actually have to do to clean up the site. This is where the vast bulk of the money gets spent. Well, I shouldn't say that's where many times the bulk of the money gets spent. Not on the actual cleanup, but on finding out how bad the problem is and what is the right way to clean it up. This process is called remedial investigation and feasibility study. Study. This is the consultant's buffet. You will see RIFS is prepared and will be supported by reams of data, rooms filled with sampling results, soil sampling, groundwater sampling, surface water sampling, adjoining properties, potential health assessment surveys of the adjoining properties. But the point of the RFS is to basically generate a list of the remedies that would satisfy surplus statutory obligation, that you select a remedy that permanently reduces the threat posed by the waste on the site. So as a result, usually you'll see a list that starts with no action, almost immediately rejected out of hand, typically, but working its way down to more and more stringent and expensive remedies. And then you pick on that spectrum of remedies which one best combines permanent protectiveness with economic effectiveness with other types of actual constraints in terms of being able to be performed. Once you have that RFS, the big moment, the record of decision. Otherwise known as a ROD. This is much shorter. The RFS could be reams and reams of paper. The ROD could be 10. Basically, the agency says, we've looked at all these remedies, this is the one we picked, and here's why we picked. This is an administrative decision that goes into record. It doesn't mean it's subject to judicial review, I'll explain that in a minute, but it does mean essentially that the agency has to document why it's picked this particular remedy and make sure it can survive arbitrary capricious challenge down the road. Get it?
Professor, so just in case you repeat the previous, because it's related to the record of decision, they're looking for permanent protection with what's that second key
portion? Well, the statute, it's actually a book as well. Yeah. The key thing is that usually the remedies are designed to obtain a permanent reduction of the threat posed by hazardous substance on the site. But you also rely on other things such as technical feasibility and economic performance. But usually it's the permanent threat reduction that's the driving factor. And believe it or not, I've mentioned consultants, I've mentioned the agency. Lawyers are involved in every step of this process. And you know, usually you will see yourself being called in when a site's been proposed for a PASI. And the client saying, what's going on? What do I need to do? And then you have you keep an eye on the process and submit comments. But the lawyer basically is a participant in this process without actually being a decision maker outside, if you're outside the agency. All right, we keep saying this. Any questions about this so far? Okay, and then after this, after the record of decision, you actually then go through the process of actually doing the cleanup. And at that point, frankly, the lawyer is going to drop out of the picture. At that point, the bulldozers are on the site, the liners are being laid, the groundwater is being pumped, and it's a rare site where you actually have continuing legal issues about the cleanup once the decision's been made. Now, with this in mind, I'm going to start talking about these two factors here. Let me add two other quick concepts for you. One is that I've mentioned that the NPL is a list of all sites. If you take a look at the NPL, you'll notice the nature of the sites that are being listed that EPA is still cleaning up has changed over the years. As a result, the type of sites you'd be pulled into is also going to be changed. What you'll see right now much more are what EPA calls mega sites. Super, super fun sites. In other words, a site where typically the remedy is going to be over $100 million. Typically, a site is going to involve a broad expanse of territory. Typically, a site is going to involve a large number of parties. Examples, there's a site in Passaic, New Jersey, where the entire Passaic River is a Superfund site, which now extends to Newark Bay. The remedy at the low end is $1 billion. The remedy may involve filling in and relocating the entire river. It's that can end with dioxin. Portion of Los Angeles Bay, Superfund site, the historical outfall of their wastewater treatment system. There's another site that basically deals with lead mining in Missouri, which basically covers nearly a quarter of the state. People living on top of lead dumps from old historical mining operations and hand tracers from Bear Run. So these mega sites are really the wave of the future. So as a result, Superfund is kind of getting a smaller program to some extent, but the cases that involve are bigger. Okay? Nick? All right. Okay. This is just sort of the way we march our site through the process. Keep in mind, though, who's doing the marching? Usually, the government is the driver. EPA fund government lead essentially means that the agency has the ability, if it wants to, once a site has either been designated for removal or remedial action, to just spend its own money and fix the darn problem. This is called a fund lead or government lead cleanup. Basically, EPA says, we're doing it. We'll worry about who to get our money from later. They pick the remedy, they pick the approach, they pick the timetable, they pick the contractors, it's all closed shop. Now, in that context, if EPA is looking to recover its money from parties down the road, I would simply ask you, will the agency have a strong incentive to economize And I'm not casting aspersions the agency here. I see people nodding their heads no. That's exactly right. The agency will tell you point blank. They will do it more expensively. That's their job.
They really say expensively?
Yes. They will say it'll be done if you let, I'll get to this in a second. The alternative is you can have the parties who did the mess, create the mess, clean up the mess privately, or otherwise known as PRP. Now, that means no government funds necessarily have to be spent except for oversight that the government has to do with the agents of the individual's actions. What that means then is that PRPs have to be persuaded by the government to do the cleanup. And this is, Nick, where I can, they have a conversation where the government will pull PRPs into a room and say, you need to clean up this site. Reason number one, you know this site, you know this waste, you have the capacity and technical expertise to clean it up efficiently and effectively, and probably for half the cost of EPA. EPA will tell PRPs that in almost bald terms. You will be able to do it more cheaply than we can. Second, I mean, I guess I should put that over here. Money. That's one reason that the agency might choose to have a private PRP do it. The second is that sometimes the agency has the ability to make the PRP clean it up. A little background. Superfund is actually a real fund. It's an actual dedicated account of money held by the federal government, which was replenished with a tax on petrochemicals. That tax was basically killed over a decade ago. And as a result, the Superfund has been slowly, slowly decreasing as a tax offender, and instead is now dependent on general allocations from Congress. That means that the government has a strong incentive to economize with the money itself in some ways. So as a result, EPA may also pull PRPs in and say, you need to take the lead on this side because I'm going to tell you to do it. Either EPA will do the cleanup itself or they'll issue what's called a 106 order, commanding the PRP to clean it up. Now, I'm not burdening you with an irrelevant and little used acronym or Section 106 order term of art. This is the nuclear weaponry of Superfund. It's the big stick. This is an administrative order from the Department of Revenue Office, which essentially EPA can issue without going to court, that directs a person to clean up, respond to a release of hazardous substances, and essentially, if you refuse to comply with it, EPA can impose penalties of $37,500 per day. EPA can also, if it deems that it's going to clean up after you refuse to do a Section 106 order, come back to you after it's done and get treble damages. At least one court has said that's treble damages on top of the actual cleanup cost. So if EPA issues an order say, spend $1 million on this cleanup site, and you say, fuck. The agency can come back to you and essentially say, I've now gone and done the cleanup I asked you to do. It cost me $1 million. I now want $3 million from you, plus another for the million that I actually spent. The other thing about that 106 order, it's called an imminent substantial endangerment order. But essentially, the 106 order is not subject to judicial review. You cannot go to court and contest a 106 order. You have to wait until the EPA actually brings a judicial action to recover the money from. So that essentially means that penalty clock is racking up the entire time because you're not able to get to court to contest the order. The other is the statute. Like those three statutory defenses, only gives you one out for a 106 order. You have to show sufficient cause. The statute does not define sufficient cause. You can see why this is high stakes poker. One thing the courts have said is sufficient cause does not include lack of financial ability to pay. Okay? So I'm sorry, Charlie, I barreled on ahead. What was your question?
Not two. One of them is, so you have the privately right there, more economic. The EPA tells the company, y'all can do it cheaper than us doing it. Is that them leveraging their 106 power, or is that like an initial, those seem like the same.
But no, remember, this is trouble damages. So say, for example...
Well, what you said was, you know, the EPA can come back and say, now it's 3 million. So are the companies thinking more economic in the sense, like, you might be hit?
Well, let me distinguish. I may have muddled up a bit. Assume you have a contaminated site. If the PRP cleaned it up, it was going to cost $1 million to clean it up. If EPA were to clean it up, just because of overhead, lack of different incentives, it's going to cost them $2 million, just because of who they are. That difference is separate apart from the 106 order penalty authority, which says EPA can get treble the money it spent. So that gets leveraged up to $6 million. Now, in one court, at least, it said that also can include the $2 million on top of that. But the penalty is $6 million.
Okay. So what does the private PRP have? What's the incentive for them to say, okay, it's more economic for us to clean, but you know, it's still a cost for us. You know,
well,
it seems like what EPA is doing is leveraging their abilities.
Absolutely. Okay. The PRP is faced with the Hobson's choice. $1 million now, potentially $6 to $8 million later.
Okay.
And gambling that they can show sufficient cost, but that's it. The eye of an eagle, that is very small.
Is the burden on EPA to prove that it was more economic PRP to do it? Initially, so why does that initial thing matter though? The EPA could say, you know, it could be more economic for the EPA to actually do it, but then it's not like that.
Well, no, there have been times, particularly, you may sound familiar, when you know, we've had EPA receive reduced government allocations under general allocations, where basically EPA just hasn't had the budget at certain times of year to undertake some of these large commitments. But by and large, if the agency has ability to switch from a fund lead to a PRP lead, guidances within the agency say that there's a preference to going with this approach. You know, that lead, notice I said fund lead. You know, this order here is actually what's called enforcement lead, where essentially you're making the PRP do it, so it's really kind of a PRP lead.
Well, the reason why I'm asking also is that the huge problem with all this is all the administrative costs. So much more money. Companies are probably going to gamble and say, it seems like they're going to probably gamble and say, well, we'll take the risk that we'll lose it.
Actually, no. Most companies do not.
Okay.
Most large companies who are clearly liable do not.
Okay.
They essentially view the end of that road as pretty hard to avoid. So they cut to the chase, solve the problem, and then a couple of other things come to them as a result that favors them. One of which is, remember that Superfund has two ways for you to get your money back if you spend them at a site. One is cost recovery under Section 107 versus contribution under Section 113F. Now you may think those sound like, if they're not twins, they're at least kissing cousins. No. There are huge, important differences between being able to bring a cost recovery action as opposed to contribution. The most important is that cost recovery gives you the ability to get joint and several liability. Usually, contribution is viewed as an equal remedy that only allows you to get several liability. Why does that matter? If you have a site with an orphan share, there's no one to pay before the contamination of this dead, deceased, fled, or bankrupt person is caused. Joint several liability, remember, means that one party is responsible for the entire payment. If you spend the money directly yourself and have a cost recovery action, you can sue all the other PRPs and say, you're joint several liable, including for that share that you know, our friends caused to have now fled the country. And you can shift that orphan share to them. That is an enormous driver, an enormous incentive for people to want to spend the money themselves up front. Second, the statute of limitations period for these two are also different. Usually contribution is keyed to 3 years after you've had to spend, if you had to pay a judgment. Cost recovery is 7 years after you finish remediation. I'm sorry, after you finish the legal action or have begun your remediation work. Much more generous, much longer term. So yes, lots of lawyer time spent on arguing about whether something is contribution versus cost recovery or whether it's renewable or remedial as a result. So is this all starting to click? Can I get a feel how this machine's working?
I just have one question. Is the $37,500 fine in addition to the triple damages? Or?
Yeah, it, like I said, nuclear weaponry. It's a very bad scene when your client gets a 106 order. And I will say EPA, in all fairness, is very judicious in issuing these orders because they cause a lot of concern. Also, the vast majority of these orders are from APM, but theoretically a couple of agencies can issue. All right, any other questions about this so far? I have got to find you an internship at EPA. That is exactly the way. I shouldn't rephrase it. That's terrible. For anyone listening on the record, the system is designed to give the agency that incentive. It also allows private parties who have a cost recovery action to have the same incentive. Instead of suing 1,000 parties, pick the 10 who have the deepest pockets who are most responsible. Sue them. And then let them carry the water, suing all the others for contribution. It's a way of leveraging, once again, limited government funding to try and get maximum recovery. But you put your finger in the heart of it right there. Any other as well, because I'll give you the flip side of that too. Suppose you're one of the unlucky minions who now have been sued by someone else for cost recovery, and you only have a contribution action. Suppose, for example, you're one of the 10 deep-pocketed companies who now are responsible for this site, but there are 10,000 other tiny little people who have shipped site materials to this site in small amounts. Not enough to qualify the de minimis exemption that we talked about last week, but a huge number of them. Each one of these parties may be responsible for it if it's like a $10 million site. They're sharing only $1,000. Is it worth chasing them? Think deviously now. You were so devious before, I almost tempted to come back to you.
Is it a way of getting at the people who made a much larger contribution just because of the government's liable? If Alan made a $1,000 contribution context outside of that, then I would want to essentially identify the other people for the...
You would be absolutely right, except we're talking about second layer defendant. Remember, we're talking about someone who has a cost recovery action who has now sued 10 other PRPs. And now these 10 other PRPs, they don't have cost recovery. They're just paying money to this guy. All they have is a contribution action. Contribution is not joint and separate. Nope. You shouldn't chew your nails, Juan. You should know that. Okay. Look at it this way. Think deviously. And by the way, what I'm about to tell you, there are actually speeches on this. I'm not giving away secrets, and I'm not casting away the negative light. Assume you're one of these 10 magnificent PRPs who now only have contribution, and you're looking at this vast array of 10,000 micro PRPs. None of those PRPs want to participate in this process for a $1,000 liability. Let me go, please. I beg you. Usually what will happen is the big PRPs will form what is called a steering committee to coordinate their actions, to create a joint defense privilege, to make sure that they speak with a unified voice, and sometimes to hire common counsel. those PRPs and the steering committee will then approach all the other de minimis PRPs and say, we're kind souls. We will let you out of this site, but we're really not sure how much this site's going to cost. Ultimately, there's some risk involved. So instead of $1,000, why don't you pay us $5? We'll let you go. Well, if you're the micro PRP, that's a good deal. You'll spend that much in a deposition with a big firm. So all these 10,000 PRPs write their checks for $5,000. Well, if you're one of the magnificent 10, suddenly you're sitting on 10,000 checks for $5,000. That's five times the allocated share to those 10 micro PRPs. It actually is a way of shifting the cost from the major PRPs through settlement to a large array of smaller parties. I'm telling you this not because it's devious or because it's, you know, again, in terms of art, this is almost guaranteed to happen at every large supercluster that has a large number of small parties. EPA does the same thing. Will also issue into what are called de minimis decrees for large global settlements for smaller parties. The premiums are typically 100%, but it goes much higher. Okay, any questions or thoughts about that? Then let me give you the last piece of the puzzle here, which is one other reason you might have a PRP jump in and you know, do the cleanup, but then also sue and settle, try and resolve, is the statute provides contribution protection. Once you settle, you're out. The statute, though, only offers limited contribution protection. The statute expressly talks about you're protected from future contribution if you settle with the government. Now, the courts have found on basis of equity and other common law principles that if you settle among private parties, you can still have some allocation of liabilities and some protection against double pay, but you don't have that absolute statutory shield that certainly is to summons the government. This gives, once again, a strong lever to the government to encourage parties to settle with them and move forward with the cleanup under EPA oversight. All right? So, looking over my notes, there is one last thing that I did want to make sure I mentioned, simply because I mentioned it earlier and I promised you I'd come back to it. When you're selecting the remedy, I mentioned that the state has the ability to put a site on the list. The state also has another important role. State law can also control the remedy if it's what's called an applicable or relevant appropriate requirement. If state law has a higher cleanup standard, even though it's still a federal cleanup, the federal cleanup has to take note of that state standard and incorporate it into its analysis and selection of remedy. So an RAR is actually fairly important. Again, that's either applicable or appropriate and relevant. It doesn't have to actually apply directly. It doesn't have to be close enough to be appropriate and relevant. All right? Okay, so with that in mind, as a way to kind of pull things together, we've got several other materials and cases that I'd like to try and synthesize with you. So with that, I'd like to sort of have some of you approach this from particular roles, particular viewpoints. So with that in mind, I'd like to start with an owner or operator. Someone who would like to be an owner or operator of a site. I'm a little worried because I know, since by appointing reading benches, the rest of you may feel like you can just sort of read real intently and you're going to escape this a little bit. But seriously, this is just going to be a thinking exercise. No? All right. So you're the owner of the site. Actually, does anyone need any of this from the prior class? So Joe, you are the owner of a site that you had nothing to do with contamination. let's, you could even just say you're a real estate broker, but the great misfortune of having a piece of property that you now own. And you've now received a letter from EPA notifying you that you are liable for a $10 million cleanup of contamination on the site. So you're shaking your head no. Okay, why not?
I wasn't responsible for the, I was unaware that they were doing these practices, whatever they were doing, I don't know the facts of the case, but I was unaware they were doing things like
Well, there are no facts of the case. Total creativity here. You have to figure out what questions you might want to ask.
Okay, yeah, what did they do, first of all, mm-hmm. the people who were on that property, right?
Oh, right now it's just basically a generic chemical manufacturing plant, small little package plant. You find them dotted all throughout the South Texas region. I mean, why would you need to show that you were not liable?
I would need to show it.
Yeah, you've got the short stick here.
Yeah.
The owner slash operator is usually EPA's go-to guy. Because the standards are so broad, you had to have had no link at all to this contamination. So anyone, if you were to hire a lawyer in the rooms, anyone could offer him some potential escape routes here?
Well, when you actually did your due diligence about whether you're an innocent owner of this property, well, did you did all your due diligence and you were unaware, and you did the phase one environmental study, you did everything you were supposed to do.
All right, Kate, I'm gonna be picky with you. The term of art, specific to the statute, is all appropriate inquiry, which effectively means due diligence, but it's an actual statutory defined term.
That's what he did.
All right. So that's your first question, Joe. Find out whether or not you have a lawsuit against your consultant, or whether or not they actually did all appropriate inquiry for you. If they did all appropriate inquiry and you didn't find it, you could be an innocent purchaser. If they did it and did find it, do you have any options there? You bought this property knowing it had contamination?
They're currently running it.
Let's say it's abandoned. Let's just say it's back right now. It's just an empty, grassy field.
Yeah. Then if nothing turned out and there was no appropriate inquiry, I'd have an argument there at least.
What?
That I was an innocent person.
But what if you knew? What if the consultant said, oh, there is contamination here and you bought it anyway?
I can say that it hasn't spread anywhere.
That might help you with allocation down the road, but remember, in addition to all the innocent purchaser, there's the complementary defense of bona fide purchaser. You can buy property knowing it is contaminated as hell. If you do all appropriate inquiry and meet the other requirements for being a bona fide purchaser, you are insulated from liability. But again, that all appropriate inquiry is looking awfully important. Let's assume you don't know right now. EPA sent you a letter. Says that you are liable, and we now want you to go ahead and do the cleanup. First question is, would you? What factors are going to whether or not you decide to say you will?
The factors that it's going to cost me less money in the long run if I do it myself.
All right, so you're ready to spend the $10 million yourself rather than have EPA spend 20?
Well, yeah, if I have $10 million, then we'll do that.
Okay.
And then see how to
who?
From the polluters, the people who carried on whatever activity resulted in the contamination, previous owners.
Okay. So who wants to be the previous owner? Max, you're sitting right there. You two can just arm wrestle literally now. All right. Turns out the previous owner actually ran this chemical plant. This chemical plant actually did cause virtually all the contamination. And basically shut down and bankruptcy. Okay, so what are you going to do? First question, do you want to spend the money and go after Max for cost recovery, or do you want to invite Max to join the party now, split the cost, and be part of your future cost recovery?
Is he existing as well?
I'm sorry?
I thought he's bankrupt.
Well,
I don't know what that means. Okay, I don't want to go after him if he doesn't have the money. That'd be a waste of resources for me, right?
All right, so anyone who might take a different perspective, Charlie? You're the pit bull now. I'll say a question. I want someone to be a pit bull. I'll come back to it.
So, there's two things.
show that someone else knew more, or was in a better position to know than he was? I remember we read a case where even though they did have their due diligence, had like really good environmental standards, the other party wasn't in a position to know at all, and so they were the ones.
Right, that's the Hercules versus Vertec case.
Yeah.
I'll say for later, there's a war story associated with that one. Bottom line is that's an allocation case. That's when you have parties who are already in the soup, you're trying to figure out who picks up which size of the piece of the pie. But what we're talking about right now basically is, does it make sense to invite Max to be a co-plaintiff, to split the cost with you up front and then sue everybody else? Or just hold Max to the side and sue him later?
Maybe you can also think about bringing an arranger for a transportation.
All right, so who wants to be the arranger? That's the nastiest, toughest job, by the way. So, Brooke, can I ask you to represent the arrangers?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Because you have a coalition. It turns out that this chemical facility actually got its feedstock from used chemicals that were generated by every other person along the ship channel. So there's a group of around 1,000 other companies. Sorry.
I was gonna say, if I just see contribution, then it's a civil liability. So I'm gonna bring everybody in. Under 107, if I get more people under
so, you see now, that's not a yes-no legal question, is it? You have a judgment call to make. You can either take this $10 million cost and spread it among as many people as you can up front, and basically, by agreement, split it before you even have a lawsuit. That's what the steering committee idea I was telling you about. And you guys decide internally. You could say, I don't want these guys. I'm going to save them to sue them later. I'll spend the money and then go after them in the future because, frankly, I don't think I want to go through the expense and trouble of tracking all these people down, of bringing them into a 10,000-member group, of trying to decide who actually is going to be in control of this thing. I want to get it done fast because I need this property done. You could have legitimate reasons to basically say, I'm going to clean up fast now with a small group and sue everyone else later because I have cost recovery with joint several liability. I can shift to them for the work that shares.
No, also, the company's in bankruptcy, I can try to sue. I will sue them and to see if there's a parent company. I will try to bring them into the case to see if there's a parent company that was an operator. Or some relation that they can also be liable.
Carlos is our pit bull. That was the idea I was worrying about letting, you notice Max is getting a kind of an easy skate here. Bankruptcy doesn't necessarily mean it's the end of the story. You have to find out whether or not the actual liability was discharged to bankruptcy. And we're not going to do bankruptcy in this class, I promise. I think I'll give you a second promise. But there may have been a corporate parent involved. It's very easy to take a subsidiary and throw it into the bankruptcy hopper. That doesn't mean there's not billions of dollars in the corporate suite upstairs. So how do we get to that corporate parent? Which case are we thinking about from our books now? Next.
I have a corporate parent wouldn't necessarily be in the neighborhood, but they qualify under that exception if they don't actually do anything as far as management of the company?
I'm going to probably go back to what I said previously. It's not a lender exemption.
Right.
It's what the definition itself means in the statute. And that was one of our cases that for our readings. So, Charlie?
Two questions. One, since there's bankruptcy, is it even worth looking to see if the bank, the creditors, if they have interest or lien or did anything to, if they did everything they could? I forgot what they supposed to do to get out of the liability, but is it worth that?
Absolutely. You want to throw this thing? I should rephrase that. Joe has a judgment call to make again. Does he want to get as big a group as possible up front, split the cost as product as possible, or sort of take his small group and barrel ahead? If it's the first, and you want a big group, why not pull in the bank? I'm betting that somewhere along the chain of title, someone had to make up the loan, and that that loan involved a property interest held by a bank. And the bank has to meet the specific criteria set in the regulations and the statute to qualify for the lender liability exemption. Okay, your second question?
Okay, and then is now time to assess whether or not the harm was proportionable?
Remember, it's a divisible or indivisible harm.
Right.
That's the fulcrum. And if there's a divisible harm, then you can apportion the harm. Everyone gets their own portion of the harm. If it's indivisible, it's joint several, and everyone carries a load. Everyone carries a load as if, you know, potentially even by themselves.
I'm sorry. You do that now. Is that going to be calculus?
Or? Yeah, I mean, to a certain extent, if there's, for example, our site is going to have two areas of contamination, one of which is just a little bit of cost, it's a little micro pocket and only one pair of feet associated with it, and it has no connection with heavy contamination on the other side of the property, then we might have a good basis for apportionment. In which case, does it make sense to pull them into this big action we're talking about, or just sell them separately in a smaller case? Yeah.
So I was going to answer two questions, guys. The first one is the
two question days. Okay. Two for two.
So I was answering. The first one is the best for the case that you were asking for, and it's the corporate veil.
This is the case we're going to get maximum.
Right.
Okay.
Well, I mean, it's very hard to pierce the corporate veil. This is the, and I guess it only applies to 107, so it's quite a hundred.
Actually, it applies to both.
Oh, no. Okay.
It's not a 107-113 case. It's a what is an owner-operator case.
And then the other one is the original question you asked before we had a parent company. Is if he is bankrupt, I prefer to just bring him in now, because even if you have to sue people later, he's on the hook for any money he gets from that suit to pay into remediation of the site. Where if he's bankrupt, he's bankrupt. And if he is a parent company,
well, let me get the 30-second Superfund bankruptcy rundown, not with the expectation you guys feel like you need to know this for a final exam, but just because it's an interesting, complex question. We actually had an entire course on this topic taught by Professor Cook, who was one of our guest lecturers. Short answer is you can discharge certain liabilities in bankruptcy, but it's by no means guaranteed. If you have a continuing ownership in the site or a presence in the site, you can discharge all your past liabilities, but you're still, at the end of the day, standing there owning the site. Unless you can abandon the property, you're still liable. If you're a past owner, you can discharge some of that, but only if you've given proper notice. In other words, you've given the creditors a heads up that you're discharging it. If you haven't, odds are, maybe most of you've done a paper, newspaper notice, you can argue the bar and discharge does not apply to your claim. So, you know, bankruptcy is worth sounding out. If we were to sue Max, even despite the bankruptcy, we might have to. Our question might be, if it's still in bankruptcy, if there's a continuing case with continuing jurisdiction, we may have to go to bankruptcy court to do it. But it's fully discharged in case it's done. It's that deal. Let's see what happens. Okay, so Best Foods. Max, I'm just kind of just sort of give you a sense. Best Foods is probably going to be an issue you're going to have to worry about. Because remember, Best Foods actually has two holdings. One is the one Nick pointed out, which is CERCLA doesn't change standards for piercing corporate veils. Very hard to do. But it does also impose operator liability on parents if parents overreach. And if your parent went beyond its appropriate role as a supervising parent and did things for the benefit of the parent to the detriment of the subsidiary, or if it had interlocking officers or interlocking employees doing duties that went beyond that appropriate role. In other words, what Justice Stevens referred to as the hats. You may actually have your billion-dollar parent liable despite the bankruptcy. Hopefully Joe's taking good notes on this and preparing his lawsuit. All right, so I haven't come back to Brooke yet, who's got this unruly crowd, 1,000 PRP sitting in a high school auditorium saying, what is this? First, Joe, what are you going to do with that? Are you going to bring them in or just sort of say it?
I'm going to profit off of it by saving them some litigation costs. Right?
By saving litigation costs? By
saving
bringing
them in? By making an offer real quick from the
All right, so basically, he's going to send you a letter saying, I'm looking at a $10 million cleanup. I just own the site. I have at most minuscule liability here. You guys shipped all the feedstock to this bankrupt, bad operator. You have the responsibility. This site may end up costing me $20 million. I have no idea. It's going to be 20 years in the future. So for a risk premium, why don't you take my $20 million and split it in 1,000 ways to be paid $200,000 and award yourself a decade of litigation?
Am I all the different?
You're on the steering committee of all the arrangers who shipped feedstock to this site.
Well, if I have the option, I'm going to go directly to the EPA and try to get as many of those EPA's amendment settlements out of the way. So if I'm going to get as many of those as I can out of it, and the rest of it, I'm going to try to prove it's divisible and dump most of it back on the operator.
I am so impressed that you weren't able, that you held back chuckling and rubbing your hands immediately as you said that. Absolutely. You don't have to play by the rules. So you could go directly to EPA.
I didn't know they were so well organized.
There, actually, you have the misfortune if you're in Houston of being where one of the most sophisticated environmental bars in the country. Only ones that come close are D.C., San Francisco, and New York. I guarantee you there'll be 10 lawyers who will immediately think exactly what Brooks suggested. You may find yourself having to juggle EPA and the BRP group is trying to do an end run around you. So, change your opinion at this point? Do you let the camel into the tent?
$100,000
each. Okay. So how are you going to keep them from going to EPA and doing a deal under your cutting your feet off of you?
I don't know.
Well, any other suggestions? I would ask you, but you've already come up with a devious idea. And Rebecca's already exhausted her deviousness quota for today. Anyone else? Do unto them as they do unto you.
Go to the EPA first.
Now, I will pretend to be EPA, bathed in a glow of heavenly light, omnipotent power, and stuck with a situation where I have two people saying, make them pay for it, or saying, I want this site. My immediate reaction is going to be, I'm not going to say Pontius Pilate, but I'm going to say, you guys work it out. So you're going to end up, ultimately, Brooke has got the ability to leverage you back to the table to talk with her at this point. So you get a sense, this is the law, the way it's designed, almost is like a gravitational field pulling in people through a liability net. We're having some type of facility discussion fairly early in the process because the stakes are so high and the liability net so large that you take an enormous risk if you don't. Okay? Now, we've only mentioned arrangers. We've mentioned past owners and operators. We've mentioned the current owner-operator. Who we missed?
Transporters.
Transporters. Who would like to represent the transporter? This is easy. These are the guys who usually get to sit in the back row. So Juan, of course, volunteers with the easy one. Okay. All right, you've gotten a letter from Joe saying, I've got a $10 million site. You transported all the waste from Brooks' clients to this site. You need to pay an equal share. What's your response?
Well, an equal share to the other parties, all the potential responsible parties?
No, an equal share for the cleanup. There's a giant pot of money, and he wants you to contribute to the pot to pay for the cleanup. Either directly for the cleanup or alternatively pay him for money he's had to spend. He's gotten the cost recovery action.
But is the damage divisible?
Interesting question. How can you apportion a transporter share?
The amount of pollutants, hazardous substances that I've shipped, or the time that
Well, that $10 million reflects 10 million gallons. You basically took all of Brooke's 10 million gallons from her clients straight to the site. Are you volunteering for 50% of the cleanup now? Even though you're basically a truck driver?
That's a tough one.
Ah. Remember the
tedious depositions I mentioned last week. Actually, Kate maybe got to mention this. What?
No, I was going to mention you didn't decide where to take it. They just contracted you to take it there. You didn't have any say where the stuff went.
You're going to throw Brooke under the bus. You're going to say, basically, I didn't choose this site. Her clients told me where to go. I'm innocent. If most, I might pay a small little sum of money to make you go away, but that's about it. That means you now have the burden of producing, it's an affirmative defense. Actually, that's not entirely true. The courts have been mixed on that. At the least, preparing for litigation, you need to verify that you can show that by the contract terms showing that she selected the site.
Transporters stick indemnity clauses into their contracts to get out of this, or does this kind of go over the contracts?
Absolutely, and that is a whole nother delightful layer to this, which we just want to have a chance to get into. Superfund expressly preserves the ability to have indemnification contracts under Section 107E. Now, what that means is that it's a half a loaf. I'm pulling you into this soup, and so far you haven't volunteered for a client yet. Juan could actually ask all of Brooke's clients to indemnify him for taking their waste. That will work vis-a-vis him and her clients. They can allocate land for themselves. What he can do is use that indemnity as a shield against the United States. The United States knocks on his door and says, pay up. And he says, wait, I've got a contract. They're responsible for it. The 107E provision says that the indemnity doesn't protect you from claims versus the government. It only works between the parties. Does that make sense? Because otherwise, people would just sort of shell game it away. Sorry?
Transport authority is demicromis.
It's demicromis.
Demicromis, yeah.
Right. De minimis or demicromis, one of the
other.
If they can show it qualifies, but remember that is something Brooke is going to have to show as an affirmative demonstration. So she's got the delightful burden of getting 10,000 of her clients together and using the paperwork to show how many of them are below the de minimis or the minimis threshold.
Is it a total that they did in business?
No, just shipments to that site.
Per shipment.
Just to that site. Okay. Now notice that's total shipments to the site. So if I'd sent 10 shipments of 50 each, I'm probably screwed, in trouble. All right. Brooke, does it matter that your clients were not intending to dispose of the material, but were actually planning to sell it as feedstock? Sort of a RCRA type question, isn't it? They didn't plan to dispose of it. They were selling it to be used as feedstock instead.
Well, we would use that in our summary judgment, trying to blame it all on the transporters, because if we weren't planning on dumping it, then we were shipping it to someone who was planning on dumping it, so they must have had some sort of idea where they were putting it. So if we can at least shed some of that on dumping
it. I like that. It kind of gets you most of the way down the road, but there actually might be an even more tedious way to just spike his cans at the very first stage. Remember Shell versus BNSF. Shell versus BNSF is a case where it has two holdings. I mentioned that previously. One of them is the Ranger liability holding. Shell was selling chemicals. Shell knew some of those chemicals were going to be spilled. The Ninth Circuit said Shell was liable as someone who arranged for disposal of the spilled chemicals, and the Supreme Court said no. Shell did not intend for those chemicals to be disposed of. They were an incidental side product of a legitimate commercial transaction. So if, once again, you've got the delightful burden of tasking your associates to plow through mountains of paperwork, but you could show that for the vast majority of your clients, they didn't intend to dispose of anything. They were selling feedstock the same way Shell was selling pesticides. The second holding may actually help Juan. Apportionment. BNSF said that it was only responsible for a small share of the site that its rail line actually went over. Supreme Court, Ninth Circuit said no, joined several. Supreme Court said, apportionment can be done in this case. There's a reasonable basis, quote unquote, for apportionment. There's no indivisible harm. There's no witch's brew. There's a reasonable basis.
I just have a question, because it seems from the reading in that case, or from my perspective, that the concept of strict liability in some kind of way is banished about the sense that, oh no, I taught them how to work with the chemicals and the hardened system. So if there's an intent and there is some knowledge and there is some, well, the concept of strict liability can be made. Diminished in the arranger sector.
Okay.
That's from my perspective.
Yeah.
So I'm asking because I have that doubt.
Yeah, and honestly, I'm not quite sure what to think about that. bless you. Wow, that's the biggest sneeze all semester, I think. Okay. So we're trying to tie all this together. I think you're getting a sense of the chess game that's taking place here. It's driven by liability standards, driven by multiple strategies, considerations, and liability exemptions. I'll try to cross it and come right back to you. Let me add the last two things you need to have in your mind when you're going through this. Extremely important. There is an enormous fundamental distinction between apportionment and allocation. Apportionment means no joint and several liability. That's the most important thing from Shell versus BNSF. If you can show apportionment, you are not looking at picking up the orphan share. You're not looking at the bankrupt share. You're not looking at additional costs. You're only paying your apportioned share. Allocation is different. Allocation means you're all in the suit, jointly and severally liable. Now you're trying to figure out a fair way to divvy it up. And there, equity makes a difference. How you act, when you act, what you did, all are risks for the court to look at or for the parties to look at and figuring out how to split the shares among themselves. That calls in usually what are called the Gore factors. Senator Al Gore proposed these for insertion into Superfund. They were not added, but every court ever since has used them as the touchstone for allocation discussions. Basically, they're all the things you'd expect the court to look at in determining whether someone's a bad actor or a good actor. And typically, your responsiveness, your equitable actions help drive down your share in allocation. That may help you, but remember, at the end of the day, though, allocation means you're jointly and severally liable. You may still be picking up that bankrupt orphan share. Okay? As much as I'd like to get, I think that's all I'm going to try and get squeezed in here. I'm going to say one last minute. Any other questions before you pick up the papers that represent your clients on Wednesday? A quick preview for those who have not seen it online yet. The site is a Superfund site of fairly modest scale with extensive metals contamination. It will involve the owners. It will involve the past owners. It will involve the parties who shipped materials to be recycled at the site. It will also involve other parties, including property brokers. So be prepared to adopt any one of those persona and be prepared to pick up exemptions that might apply. The idea here is not to prepare full-fledged, technical, detailed position papers. The idea is just to be able to sort of figure out how the negotiations of a settlement like this are going to take place after our discussion here today. Okay? All set? All right. Then is everyone signed the signing sheet? We all set? All right, I'll see everyone on Wednesday.
That's our question.
Oh, I'm sorry. Answer sheets, if anyone wants them.
You say ECHOAC, action drives down the allocation. Does Hercules, when they were doing all the